Unrooted is a podcast by the Indigenous Foundation focused on centering Indigenous voices and stories. Through Unrooted, we hope to dismantle systems of oppression and uproot the deeply ingrained issues and racism that exist against Indigenous peoples to this day. We hope to share intersectional holistic perspectives through our discussions with Indigenous and Afro-Indigenous advocates and changemakers.
Welcome back to another episode of 21 Things.
If this is your first time listening in, we are your hosts, Roa and Izzy.
We are so excited to be back exploring the 21 things you may not know about the Indian Act. We have really enjoyed these episodes and the knowledge and awareness we're gaining through the process.
For sure, I couldn't agree more. But as always, we'd like to preface this with a content warning, as these are heavy and in times really difficult topics to absorb. So please listen with caution and take your time with it. And with that, let's get into it.
Okay, so the first topic we're going to delve into in this episode is item 5 of the Indian Act, and it discusses how portions of reserves could be expropriated for public works.
Okay, first off, can we just get a definition of expropriate?
Yes, we can. So expropriation is the act of a government claiming privately owned property against the wishes of the owners, ostensibly to be used for the benefit of the overall public, which in this case is the European settlers.
Of course.
Yeah. So this policy was added in 1876, and it outlined how any private group or level of government could take advantage of Indigenous land. Mm. Expropriation would occur whenever a group or government wanted a way through the land.
Wow. Okay. So again, this question always comes up, but did Indigenous people have any say in this?
No, of course not. None of this had to be approved by Indigenous peoples, even though it was their land.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
So it was actually the government that got to sign off on any expropriation. So they, of course, were the ones who got to control it. And again, another situation where the government spoke on behalf of Indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So another terrible fact I learned while researching this topic was the fact that eventually the government had the ability to remove Indigenous bands if they thought they were too close to cities of 8,000 or more people.
Wow. Oh, yeah. My God.
Yeah, exactly. I was completely, like, not shocked by this fact, because it does seem something that the government would do. However, just another horrific piece of history.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And of course, this was simply to appease the settlers and make sure they were comfortable at all times at the expense of Indigenous peoples.
Of course. This is how it always is, how it's been for just centuries. My God.
Exactly. Yeah. We always keep coming back to that.
Oh, yeah. So wasn't what happened on the Kitsilano Reserve an example of this? It just happened under the south side of the Burrard Bridge in Vancouver, BC.
Yes. So it was totally an example of this. And I do have, like, some information to provide people with a little kind of outline of how this expropriation kind of worked. So the timeline of this event was 1869 to 2002. So it really didn't end that long ago. And it did begin when 37 acres were set aside at the mouth of the False Creek for Indigenous peoples.
Mm.
And eventually it expanded to 80 acres, which were allotted to the Squamish Nation peoples. And so around 1901, the Canadian Pacific Railway obtained a right of way for 7 acres of the land.
Wow.
Yeah. And so then again, over the years, more acres were taken away from the Squamish Nation and used for various reasons.
Mm.
Like in 1911, the Indian Act is amended, so there is no need for band council approval. Oof. So gave the government the right to relocate the reserve whenever they saw fit.
Wow. Oh my God.
Right? And so if this wasn't enough, the government then used bribes to get the Squamish Nation to sell their land. And when this occurs, Indigenous people's belongings are sold off and their houses are burnt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it wasn't enough for them to take like little portions of the land. They just came in and took everything.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the Burrard Street Bridge got some acres. The National Defense got land, especially during World War II. And in 1977, the Squamish Nation launched legal efforts to get back portions of their land. And in 2002, they won back a small portion.
Mm.
So we are going to discuss another item within the Indian Act, item 11, which is restricted Indigenous peoples from leaving their reserves without permission from their Indian agent. And we decided to do this because it fits really well in as we're talking about reserves already in regard to like the expropriation.
Yep.
And we wanted to bring in another item to this episode. But before we talk about that, we have to talk about the Red River Rebellion and the Northwest Resistance.
Yes. So the Red River Rebellion is super important. It occurred in 1869 to 1870. It was the Red River Colony against the Canadian government, and it was sparked due to the transfer of territory of Rupert's Land from HBC to the new country of Canada. Now, the Métis people living there felt their culture and land rights would be compromised, and they were right, of course. Under Canadian control. So they mounted a rebellion and declared a provisional government to negotiate terms for entering Confederation. And this led to the creation of Manitoba and the emergence of the Métis leader Louis Riel.
Yeah, so moving on to the Northwest Resistance, before we talk about it, we kind of wanted to give a little content warning just because it was a violent event and it did result in many tragedies for many individuals and their families.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the Northwest Resistance was a violent 5-month insurgency against the Canadian government, fought mainly by Métis and their First Nations allies in what is now Saskatchewan and Alberta. Mm-hmm. And it was sparked due to the fear of the rapidly changing West. And this resistance resulted in hundreds of people dying due to a series of battles and other outbreaks of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the resistors were eventually defeated by the federal troops, and it resulted in a permanent enforcement of Canadian law in the West, and also the conviction and hanging of Louis Riel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we would also like to mention that these descriptions are very shortened versions of these effects, and there were so much more that went into them and many more details that we don't touch on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now moving on to item 11 itself. It came into play when colonizers had determined that they would be, quote unquote, safer if Indigenous peoples were not allowed to leave their reserves without permission from their Indian agent.
Wow. Oh my God. Why did they feel that they would be safer? It seems like this just could be heading towards the creation of a really harmful stereotype.
Yeah, it for sure did. And it occurred because after the Red River Rebellion and the Northwest Resistance, settlers were not eager to move to Saskatchewan because they felt unsafe after all the unrest, even though Indigenous peoples were simply trying to protect their culture, themselves, and their communities.
Right.
The Prime Minister at the time, John A. Macdonald, wanted to ease the fears of the white people and encourage them to move. So he accomplished this by inhibiting Indigenous people from congregating.
Mm. That's insane. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did they enforce this? Like, what was the system that they actually used to ensure Indigenous peoples didn't leave their reserves?
Well, it was much like the pass system that many schools had when you asked to go to the bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
Indigenous peoples had to receive a pass from their Indian agent. And notices were posted on the Treaty 6 reserves warning Indigenous peoples from leaving without a pass. Wow. And the pass they got showed how long the individual was allowed to be off the reserve for, the purpose of their time away, and whether or not the individual was able to carry a gun.
That's insane. Oh my God.
So another fact about this item was that it was never officially written into the Indian Act, and it was acknowledged that the Prime Minister had no legal ability to enforce this. However, it did not stop Indian agents from enforcing it to their heart's content.
Of course. This is just a ridiculous restriction.
Yeah.
it's all, these are all just really ridiculous. And like, what would happen if indigenous people didn't actually obey them?
So people were punished when they didn't obey these new restrictions, of course, and police would arrest those found off the reserve without a pass.
Wow.
So this was horrific. And as if obtaining a permit wasn't enough punishment, as it was a horrible act in itself, because in order to obtain a pass, Indigenous peoples would sometimes have to travel days on foot to the Indian agent's house, and they never really knew if they would be there. Right? So if the Indian agent turned out not to be there after days of traveling, they would either have to camp out and wait or leave and come back another time.
Wow. Now, okay, did this just apply to reserves?
No, actually. Yeah, that's a great question. In 1889, parents required a pass to visit their children at residential schools.
Wow.
Of course. Yeah. So the agents were encouraged to only give out at max passes 4 times a year for parents.
Oh my god.
So they could only see their kids 4 times a year. Yeah, just horrific. So like, we will discuss this aspect of Diamond More Debt's during our episode on residential schools and the part the Indian Act played in them.
Now, the second topic for today's episode is item number 6 of the Indian Act, which is renaming Indigenous people to European names. So in the 19th century, the colonial government started to collect a record of all those who self-identified as Indian. Now, these records helped the settler agents of the Crown to figure out who was eligible for certain benefits under some treaties. But it was mostly just a way to keep track of the Indigenous populations and really maintain a level of control over them.
Of course.
Of course. So the settler state really had one main goal in the 19th century, which was the assimilation of all Indigenous peoples. So one way to do that was by renaming the entire population, giving them European names.
Okay, so my first question is, how did renaming Indigenous peoples contribute to the assimilation?
Okay, well, short answer was to cut off their ties to their traditions. But to just talk about it further, the settler government did it to erase every single tie with that the Indigenous people had with their cultures. But they also feared that if they were to leave them with their traditional names, then it would just make it harder to assimilate them, to remove them from their societies and place them in European societies. Because their traditional names connected them to their cultures and their history, and the colonizers wanted to take that all away, right?
Totally, like kind of take away part of their identity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But also, the Europeans found their traditional names difficult and confusing to pronounce. And to even understand. So giving them European names just made it easier for the settlers to register them in their records.
It was all about making their job easier.
Yep, making their job easier. And Indigenous peoples didn't have Christian names or like a last name, a surname. They actually had a variety of names, and they ranged and differed in the different stages of life of an Indigenous individual.
So my next question to you is, why did Indigenous peoples have a variety of names throughout their lifetime? And what was their connection to the names that they had or were given?
Okay. So first off, they would identify themselves through their hereditary name, spirit name, family, clan, and animal name. So many different names.
Yeah.
Now, in some cultures, hereditary names carried an immeasurable wealth and power and responsibility of the individuals. And the names that they were given at their birth was just like one of many. And it was just for that particular stage in their life. And with every new stage came new names for them that symbolized their journey throughout their life and their experiences, as well as their milestones and just their character.
I feel like that's super important because people do change immensely throughout their lifetimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It represented them at any given moment in their life stages. It represented them.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. But now, of course, none of that was reflected in the names that they were given in the renaming process by the settlers. That was all just erased and taken away from them by giving them Christian names.
Totally, because why would the settlers want Indigenous people's values and culture to be represented?
Yeah, exactly. Now, like I said earlier, one of the reasons that renaming happened was because the government agents found the traditional names to be difficult, and all the traditional naming practices just didn't make sense to the agents, which comes from the complete and utter ignorance of the colonizer. Just no consideration whatsoever to reflect and understand other cultures.
No, of course not, because they believed that their culture was the superior one. So why even bother examining or trying to understand even the littlest bit about someone else's culture?
Exactly. Especially that their whole mission was to erase Indigenous peoples off the face of the earth, whether it was by assimilation or murder. So what's the point of learning?
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So now in the renaming process, the settler agent would give a man a Christian name and then also a non-Indigenous surname, while a woman was given a Christian name, but then her surname was that of her husband's or father's, the one that her husband or father was given.
Oh, we love that.
Mm.
Women weren't allowed their own surnames.
Yeah.
So my question is, how did the settlers decide which names to give to Indigenous peoples? And I assume I already know the answer to this question, but was there any thought that went into it?
Okay, so, well, like we said before, there was no connection, right? Their names that were given to them, like their traditional names had. So the names were very arbitrarily chosen.
Just random.
Yeah, just absolutely random. But the names that were assigned to them were biblical names to follow with that Christian missionary type.
Yep.
And sometimes it was just the names of the agents themselves.
No.
Yeah. So the agents would go from one place to another, and they would often just repeat the names, run out of names, run out of ideas for names, either give them your name or just keep on repeating those names. So that just explains that how there's a lot of the same last names given to many people who just have no connection or relation to one another. So let's just take a step back and talk about names here for a second. Names hold an immense power.
Totally. Right?
They carry your history and your ancestors' history. And to have that replaced with one that has no significance to you is such a ruthless and pernicious method of erasure of the Indigenous individuals and their communities as well.
Totally. And not, like we mentioned before, but like their identity, like so much of an individual's name, like, is included in their identity. That's how people recognize you. That's how people identify with you.
Mm-hmm.
And to get rid of that is major.
Especially that we talked about their, how their names are chosen and what kind of names they were given, right? It represented them throughout their life stages.
Totally. And like at specific events in their life, their name could be changed to represent them.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a new random name, it's not going to represent who you are.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's another way of taking away their autonomy, right? So the colonizers were under this impression that through policies like this one, First Nations would abandon their cultures and their traditions, and they could just easily blend into the European society, which would eliminate the Indian problem that they had, as they liked to call it.
Yeah, and we have discussed how disgusting that is in past episodes before.
Now, the deputy minister of the Indian Affairs in the early 1900s, named Duncan Campbell Scott, spoke about these assimilation policies in a statement, saying, quote, "The happiest future for the Indian race is absorption into the general population. And this is the object and policy of our government. Our object is to continue until there is not a single Indian in Canada that has not been absorbed into the body politics, and there is no Indian question and no Indian department." Quite despicable.
So, since we've talked a lot about names and the power that they hold, and how when they were given random names, Indigenous peoples lost a part of themselves. Were they allowed to use their traditional names in any situation, or were they completely forbidden?
Yeah, they were completely forbidden. And most individuals couldn't use their names, even in their traditional family names, even in residential schools and day schools and the 60s scoop as well as the millennial scoop, which these are layers that are just added on layers totally. Of
assimilation. And most of them we will get into later on.
Yes. But so this was, again, just another method of assimilation, putting them in these situations, residential schools, for example, and within residential schools, not being able to use their names. And so there's just countless stories told by Indigenous peoples on the terror and abuse that they faced in residential schools for just using their traditional names. So they were absolutely forbidden from that.
That's absolutely horrific.
Mm-hmm. So reclaiming their names is such an essential part of Indigenous resurgence. And in 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada actually released a final report that included the recognition of Indigenous traditional names.
Oh, I didn't know that was a part of it. Yeah. Did they actually do anything?
See, that's the thing. I also didn't know that was a part of it. I never heard of that. And it's been years since the report was released, and it didn't actually they didn't do anything until just very recently, this past year actually.
Wow.
Yeah, as expected, honestly. But they did do something. So the federal government made the decision to allow name changes to official documents. And this policy applied to all individuals of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis backgrounds. So everyone who's just been anxious from using their traditional names and official documents for all of these years. So I just want to note that the announcement actually came last year as the country kept discovering hundreds of unmarked graves at former residential schools. So this brought a new focus on the vicious and bloody colonial past of this country, and everyone was shocked by it. And as we kept learning about more mass graves, people were just so shaken by it. And those who have never even questioned Canada as a settler state began questioning it, which, of course, puts a lot of pressure on the government.
Yeah, they were finally being seen by the general public in their true monstrous image, as it should be.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was really the pressure of the public, the pressure of Indigenous people trying to reclaim their rights and gain some semblance of justice that drove the government to finally take some level of action, which was this, to allow name changes for Indigenous people.
Yeah, honestly, it's a small win, but it's powerful nonetheless, because like we talked about, like, names hold so much power and people should be able to identify with their name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think just this whole situation shows us the potential and strength that we hold in sharing knowledge, right? By uncovering these mass graves and by broadcasting it across social media and the news, we got to hear the stories of Indigenous peoples who faced the atrocities of residential schools. And the public was just really riled up and angered by this bloody history. And it was really nice to see everyone kind of getting together and finally speaking up about this and wanting to atone for it. And the government trying to, you know, save face, they ended up finally fulfilling one of the 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation report.
And that's all we have for you all today.
We really appreciate all those listening in and learning about these topics alongside us.
For sure. And before we end today, I wanted to say, as a settler myself, I often reflect upon my privilege and my part in all of this. And I encourage you as settlers to do the same by thinking critically about your life, your experiences, your interactions with racism, and your privilege of simply learning about these topics instead of experiencing them.
Absolutely. And in the words of Walter Rodney, "For the only great men among the unfree and the oppressed are those who struggle to destroy the oppressor."